Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 24th of November. Joining us in just a few moments, we're trying to track him down. David Plouffe will be with us. David's book, The Audacity to Win, The Inside Story and Lessons of Barack Obama's Historic Victory. He began his career in politics, canvassing door-to-door in Delaware and Iowa, has managed two U.S. Senate races, a congressional race, and the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, serving as Democratic leader Dick Gephardt's deputy chief of staff in 97-98, and in 2001, joining forces with David Axelrod and served as lead strategist on Barack Obama's successful U.S. Senate campaign. He managed Obama's presidential campaign and helped set up Organizing for America. And he will be joining us momentarily to talk about his book. He and David Axelrod began, as he writes in the book, their journey walking together through an airport in November of 2006. To their first meeting about the far-fetched prospect of Barack Obama's running for president. He, of course, had met with Axelrod a little bit earlier. I take you back to the year 2002. He was meeting with Axelrod, although they were not working together closely, but they were looking at business operations for 2003 and 2004. And the main topic of conversation was the Illinois Senate race in 2004, which would be an open seat. There were two main Democratic contenders. One had a great deal of money, millions to spend on his campaign. The other was the state controller, who would have the endorsement of the state party and lots of labor unions. It was considered a strong favorite. And then Axelrod announced that he didn't want to work for either. Instead, he thought that they should work for a little-known state senator named Barack Hussein Obama, who was given zero chance to win by the political establishment. It was 14 months after September 11th, and most believe that his name alone would sink his candidacy. Axelrod said, one of the other guys will probably win, but Barack Obama is the kind of guy who should be in the U.S. Senate. He is bright and principled, skilled legislatively, and committed to a politics that lifts people up. I think that's who we should work for. And one of the colleagues said, let me get this straight. We should work for the candidate with no chance, no money, and the funny name. As I keep telling you guys, Axelrod wryly replied, I am a terrible businessman. So that was that, and that was the beginning of the association of all these people, Robert Gibbs included, who became the architects of the many would say, and I think rightly so, one of the most historically significant campaigns for president in the history of the office. It was quite extraordinary to take on what they took on and how they won the whole thing. So we'll be talking with David in just a moment. We're on the phone with his publicist trying to track him down, which I hope can happen soon because we've been expecting him and reading the book. And I know that many of you would like to speak with him as well. A lot of the book focuses to the early part. They realized that they had to concentrate on certain states. And of course, Iowa was one of those states. I've said this before on the air, but it was one of our great pleasures to take this show to Dubuque, Iowa, because a listener called in and said, hey, you ought to come to Dubuque for the caucuses. And we said, well, okay, we'll go to Dubuque. And we just had a wonderful time talking with people from all of the campaigns, Democratic and Republican campaigns. And we went to the caucuses that night and discovered there was something going on then because of what was happening in the caucuses and the number of people who probably hadn't voted before, particularly number of young people who were in the audience. And all of us who went to caucuses thought, yeah, there was a chance that this guy with the funny name who wasn't given a chance of doing anything may win this, even though everybody said quite the opposite. So that was a really interesting night. And of course, that election was one that we covered so extensively for a long period of time. And the book goes into it. It's a very forthright account of what happened during that long, long run and how Obama made the decision and how he wanted to balance family and the campaigning and what Michelle Obama had to say about that, because it's not easy to be caring for two young children by yourself while he's on the road all this time. So it's about that. And, you know, he was down at some points. I still wonder, you know, how a president does his job. And you wonder how these people carry on with these campaigns, the length of that campaign and the airplane travel all the time and getting 2 hours of sleep a night all too frequently. How do people do that? It's just extraordinary. And why they chose to make that sacrifice, because Plouffe was in the same situation himself. He had moved his family to Chicago. His wife had to put graduate school on hold for a while so he could run this campaign, which was a huge job. He thought about it, you know, long and hard, and was hoping that Obama wouldn't ask him to run the campaign. And then, of course, Obama asked him, and he said, yeah, I'll do it. And his wife actually was encouraging him to do it, thinking it was an important event for him to be a part of. And so he tells poignant stories of being away from home at a time when he really needed to be at home, and looks at all of that, and then the campaign, and running against Hillary Clinton, and the mistakes that they made early on by not focusing on some of those early caucus and primary states, because once you won Iowa, the wind, as they say, was at your back, and you could do better as you moved along. And we also hope, well, first we hope to find him, and we also hope that we'll be able to hear his comments about how he has governed so far, whether there are some people who are dissatisfied with the course that the president has taken, thinking that he has not been forceful enough on issues like health care reform, which he talked about frequently in this campaign. They are concerned about what his announcement will be concerning Afghanistan. There are many who think that we should be withdrawing from Afghanistan instead of adding forces. So we'll be talking about that with David as well. So we just have to find David. And once we do that, we can carry on this conversation. Although I'm perfectly willing, because I've read a lot of this book, I could talk about the book with you. I could just be David for the next 45 minutes. He's never missed an interview before, his publicist said, so we hope it's not an emergency of some kind that's holding him up from conversation with us. But I have a feeling that we'll get him fairly soon. In the meantime, we can welcome phone calls from you. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. When you read the early part of the book, I still sometimes, when I look at the president, I'm still in this frame of mind, think, isn't this amazing that he became the president of the United States? It's, you know, one-term senator from Illinois with not a huge long record, and that he was able to take on a very large political establishment, I think, is pretty amazing. How did it happen? And David, of course, details that. So we can also talk about how he's governing now and whether or not you're enthusiastic about the way he's governed. Are there promises that you feel that he has not kept, or has he gone above your expectations? We certainly welcome your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655 for you to join the conversation. And we do hope to get David in here at some point. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. So what the heck? Let's go to phone calls. David from Ironwood. Hi, David.
Hello. I was hoping to talk to him.
Yeah, so am I.
I campaigned for Obama, and I really like how he's trying to get health care through and stuff, and I really hoped it passes. The one thing I sort of want to ask him is if I have the idea of one plan, price, same price. It really would help the whole healthcare thing. Since small businesses would pay the same as large businesses, it would be like 90% of the things sold in America are sold this way. They put a price on it and they sell it to everyone without discrimination. But, you know, healthcare,
all right,
they could discriminate on.
Yeah. All right. Thanks very much. We did find David. So thank you, David, for your call. And we'll welcome phone calls. I know we've been talking about his appearance. So get your calls in line and we'll take them, you know, pretty soon at 800-486-8655. Hi, David. I'm so glad you're with us. Hi.
Sorry about the mix-up. We had some time zone issues, but thanks for having me on.
That's all right. We're glad to have you here. You start the book, and you bring us back to this moment, David, when you and David Axelrod were walking through an airport in 2006, your first meeting about the far-fetched prospect of Barack Obama's running for president, and then walking down the hallway of the high-rise that had housed your campaign on the way to greet the president-elect. And I think that, and you talk about meeting the security guards who were crying and were breaking into raucous cheers. You know, when you remember that night, no matter where you were on the political spectrum, that was a night of great emotion. And for you, you must have thought, oh my gosh, we did this. We did this.
Well, it's interesting. You know, the history of it really wasn't something we focused on very often. But yeah, that moment was powerful just because to see you know, that kind of emotion from African-American security guards. And it was beyond just, you know, hey, we're glad we won. It was sheer elation. So,
right.
Yeah, I think that it was a long 2 years. And so, you know, with a very, very, in the beginning, a huge, we were huge underdogs. And so looking back at all that we accomplished was obviously gratifying. But in the aftermath of the election, I think all of us heard from people in this country and around the world. And, you know, I'm sure in Wisconsin, I heard about people in Madison and Milwaukee. Just a remarkable outpouring after the election was called. And, you know, it was a meaningful thing. It's a humbling thing to have been part of something like that.
Mm-hmm. You've written, I know, recently about reminding us of one of the things that Obama wanted to do was change our stature in the world. I think most people would agree that he has done that to a significant degree in the short time he's been in office.
No doubt. And I think that, you know, this was always a driver in the election, in both primary and general. The sense voters had that we did need to rebuild and strengthen our relationships, particularly younger voters. They understand how closely connected all of us are as a community of nations. So I think that that's changed in meaningful ways. I think it's going to pay huge dividends for the country in the years to come. I also think that our relationship with the Muslim world, particularly with young Muslims, is going to be strengthened. And, you know, my sense is that there's going to be less young people who choose the route of terrorism because they look at America a little bit differently than they did.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. Take us back for a while. I'm interested in hearing your story. These early talks about Obama maybe running for president, and you're thinking, oh, gee, I hope he doesn't ask me to be campaign manager. I'm going to have to move my family. My wife wants to go back to graduate school. I've got a young son. And then he asks you to be campaign manager, which you knew was going to happen. And your wife had some interesting things to say to you, convincing you you should take this. Talk about your reservations and how you finally said yes and why you said yes.
Well, and my reservations were twofold. They were personal, obviously, with a young family and wanting to grow it. My wife had some things planned. You know, that would disrupt all of that. And, you know, there are no shortcuts in a campaign like this. You have to give yourself over to it. So, you know, there is no, and this is something we had to talk to Barack Obama about before he ran, there is no middle ground. There's no seeing your family a lot. There's just, you can't do it. You've got to run at sprint pace. The second thing was it had been a long time since I had managed. I had been a consultant. There's a difference. You know, a lot of people who are listening to you probably know the difference. It's different to give advice and strategy from being the person on the line every day for every decision, major and minor. And so I wasn't sure I, A, wanted to go back to that, or B, you know, I was ready to do that because I might be a little bit rusty. So, and by the way, the hesitation had nothing to do with whether or not we thought it was likely we were going to win. We all thought that the pathway to success was quite narrow and that, you know, if you were realistic with yourself and honest with yourself, you would assume this would be a one-year endeavor, not a two-year endeavor.
Right.
So those were my, you know, hurdles. And my wife basically said, listen, you complain about the quality of the campaigns and the politics. Now, you have, you know, some blame for that because you're in the business. But here's a guy who you really respect a great deal, who seems to offer the promise of the kind of campaign you've always dreamed of doing. So isn't it a little bit hypocritical not to, you know, let's try and make this work? And so that really jolted me out of my the decision-making problems I was having, and so I jumped in.
I don't understand, and please explain this to me, the grueling schedule that you lived for so long, that the president still lives and lived during that time. Anybody who's running for this kind of office, 2 hours of sleep, 2 hours of sleep the next night, maybe no sleep the next night. I don't know how people physically do this, David. How did you do it?
Well, you know, first of all, you know, there are some nights, you know, where you're able to get a little sleep, you know, a Friday night or Saturday night, so you catch up where you can. But part of it is, you know, the intensity is so high, the adrenaline is kicking in, that you are able to and you're just busy all the time. You don't even really notice that you're tired. It's when you slow down that you notice that you're tired. It's why so many people tend to get sick after campaigns, because, you know, their body will finally let them slow down and everything catches up to them. But so it is intense. And, you know, I think that what's hard is, you know, you have to think, too. And so it is hard to think. And so I did try and find ways to, you know, whether it was going for a run or some quiet time on a Sunday afternoon, I would try and have some time to think, because that's one of the tricks here, is to make sure that you're not just executing in the moment, but also looking down the field and you know, beginning to plan down the road. And so it's grueling, no doubt. And for our volunteers, too, listen, a lot of people listening to you in Wisconsin helped us in both primary and general. And, you know, they've got jobs, they've got families, yet somehow they're finding 20, 25, 30 hours a week to visit to the campaign.
Right.
You know, from my perspective, it was heroic how they found the time to do that.
Yeah. You decided early on, and maybe this was a problem because they didn't have the same kind of idea in the Clinton campaign, that there were only going to be a very few of you who were going to be sort of the tightly knit group that knew what the strategy was, that was going to respond, and people who had their particular jobs, who's going to respond to the press, et cetera. So people never really went off message.
That's right. And well, we made a couple of mistakes, and I write about them in the book, where, you know, Barack Obama was unhappy with the tone of something we said. And this is very different than well, pretty much any campaign I've certainly been involved in, where, you know, you try not to be snarky or too political or, you know, take the cheap low shot. I mean, he was very much, and again, we ran a tough campaign. We had arguments with John McCain about any number of issues, but they were about issues. And I think that it showed that you could win the right way, which you could really, you know, talk to voters like adults. If somebody took a cheap, low shot at you, you know, the political playbook says, well, then you need to go lower. You know, we didn't do that. And it's something I think we're all proud of, is that we were, and he played that role. He policed the campaign in that regard, the tone of things. I write in there that, you know, we had an initial exchange with the Clinton campaign over one of their former contributors, David Geffen, who said some things about Bill Clinton, and they asked us to distance themselves. And, you know, we kind of shot back in an overheated, snarky way. And, you know, Barack Obama said, listen, that's not what we're going to do here. You know, we can make our point without, you know, going in that direction. And so he played a very valuable role, and it was all throughout the whole 2 years of the campaign he did that.
We don't think of him getting mad very often, but there are just a couple instances, and it's when that happened that you were giving the press something that wasn't who he was that made him angry.
That's right. I think he there was one famous incident where we had a what's called a research memo, which is just something you give on background to the press about an outsourcing issue in Hillary Clinton. And, you know, we were sloppy with it, and you know, I think the impression, if you read it, was that we were suggesting, you know, being, you know, that close to folks in India was a bad thing. And that's just, you know, now again, you know, generally these things never see the light of day. So we learned our lesson, which is, you know, don't ever put anything on paper or share anything that you can't stand by. And Barack Obama at that moment wasn't just angry. He was disappointed in his campaign, which is always a more powerful response.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think we really, from that moment on, tried to be really careful about it and trafficked in that sort of thing a little bit more carefully than other campaigns had done.
I was telling our audience, and they, of course, many of them were listening, we took our show to Dubuque for the caucuses. We're not on the road very much, but I'm kind of a political junkie, and a lot of the audience members are as well. So we went there and had a lot of, you know, people from the campaigns and kind of hunkered down in Iowa and went to the coffee shops. And when we went to the caucuses that night, David, it was like, whoa, there is a big thing going on in this state. And all the people we had on the air were saying it's going to be Hillary Clinton. Everybody predicted this. Nobody saw this guy. And then you read what happened in your book. You knew you had to win that state. It was Iowa.
Well, it was Iowa or bust. I think David Axelrod said that, and that's true. So our entire, you have to understand that, the year of 2007, all was, for us, viewed through the prism of Iowa. Everything, money we spent, time we spent, strategic decisions were all about, does this help us win Iowa? Now, the difficult thing when we made the determination that we had to win Iowa was we could not win Iowa if the people who always showed up to go to the caucuses showed up. That's a pretty daunting revelation, by the way. So you must win state. You can't win unless something really fundamental changes
right.
to the electorate.
Yeah.
And that's what we did. And what you saw in Dubuque was, you know, the caucus in many respects turned into a primary. You had a lot of people who never went to caucuses before, mm-hmm. but maybe voted in general elections come. You had a lot of young people, many new registrants. You had independents and Republicans changing their registration. And I write in the book, changing the electorate was a thread that ran through our whole campaign. It started in Iowa, but it went all the way through to November 4th, where, you know, we essentially tied McCain with people who had voted in the Bush-Kerry race. But we won a 44-point margin with people voting in their first election. So that was the tail of the tape. And if you look at the Wisconsin primary, by the way, you know, the electorate changed there in meaningful ways, too. I mean, we obviously probably would have won Wisconsin with just the average, you know, the electorate that came out in 2004. But the reason we won with such a big margin, when obviously margins are how you produce delegates, was a lot of younger people came out. You know, a lot of first-time primary voters came out. So that was a very, very important part of our campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think was it probably is properly appreciated at the moment, but that's what we were doing every day.
Right.
That's what we measured. Are we changing the electorate in profound enough yeah. ways to win?
You sure did. And what happened with the Clinton campaign? Why did they neglect Iowa? Did they really think that she was the front runner and they didn't have to pay attention to that state?
Well, it's interesting, you know. Well, first of all, you know, they did end up outspending us there. And, you know, for the latter part of 07, they were there as much as we were. I think it was that, you know, they didn't get started as urgently as we did. And I, first of all, you know, they probably thought, in the very beginning, John Edwards had a big lead on both of us. And, you know, I think they thought correctly that, well, even if Edwards won Iowa, they could wear him down later because he's not going to have the organization or the money, et cetera. Now, as Edwards began to falter through the summer, I think that they thought, well, you know, we'd like to win Iowa. Obviously, we're going to try and win Iowa. But if we don't win Iowa, we're such a strong front runner, we can recover from that. And by the way, there is some truth to that. They're the only person in this race that could have lost Iowa and been the nominee, in my view.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think they understood that a loss in Iowa as a big national, you know, they were running as the inevitable nominee, that would cause everybody to look at them differently and look at us differently. And one thing happened over the course of the first 6 months of the campaign that made our Iowa strategy, I think, sounder, but he put more pressure on us to win. You know, we weren't going to simply be, as we thought we might be in the beginning, we win Iowa, but then we don't have any organization or money really elsewhere. We have to scramble to take advantage of Iowa. But by the end of June or July of 07, we had more money than Hillary Clinton, and we had more organization. We saw what was going on in Wisconsin. People were using social networking sites and gathering offline to organize the state well before we put staff on the ground. So what we saw was, wow, if we win Iowa, you know, this isn't just going to be a Johnny one-note kind of thing where we got to catch lightning. Like, we're going to be powerful. We're going to have more money and more organization than Hillary Clinton. We could have never expected that.
No.
So seeing that, though, they should have seen that. You know, that's even if they didn't appreciate Iowa before, when I was like, well, okay, Edwards, Obama could win Iowa. We'll finish them off later. When we were growing into such a powerful force, that's, in my view, where they should have done. They should have realized, if we let this guy get out of Iowa, we got trouble on our hands.
You also had to sell him. Did you try to sell? I'm wondering what you initially saw in him and what Axelrod saw in him to take on this guy who likely wasn't going to win anything back in 2004. And how did you translate what you saw in him to the people in Iowa? Was it through placing him in, you know, at the fairgrounds and riding bumper cars, et cetera, or through speeches, or what was it?
Well, you know, we saw him in 2004, you know, this is when he was running for the U.S. Senate as a big underdog there in Illinois. You know, he was someone of great, I thought, vision and intellect and someone who we saw could inspire. We saw this in Illinois on a much smaller scale. Really inspire people to get involved in politics to a degree, you know, I had not seen in some time. So, you know, I thought this would be a terrific addition to the United States Senate. He's exactly the kind of guy we need more of. Now, none of us thought back then he'd run for president. He didn't think that. So after he decided to run in Iowa, we really benefited from having a year to be on the ground, you know, and spend time there. And we obviously were able to do a lot of TV ads and other things like that. But the most important thing was these people many of them saw him in person. Many of them saw him giving very lengthy interviews on Iowa TV stations. And so that was a benefit. And that's what made the later contests harder and fraught with peril is, as you remember in Wisconsin, Barack Obama didn't get to spend that much time on the ground. I mean,
mm-hmm.
we were essentially there for, I think, 4 or 5 days. And, you know, by that point, people in Wisconsin knew him better than they obviously did before Iowa, but still not, you know, they hadn't seen him very much. So that was what made the latter part of the calendar always difficult for us, is we learned that time on the ground with him, because people didn't really know much about him. And he's a great communicator, and obviously he's great on television, but I think he's even better in a room where people can kind of see him and ask him questions.
Yeah.
So that you know, but in Wisconsin, that, you know, we would have loved a lot more time on the ground, but we had to deal with the, you know, sort of the reality of the calendar.
The book is pretty honest. You chide yourselves for not really investigating Reverend Wright, his every statement, his every word at the pulpit. It could have, I think, really derailed the whole campaign.
Well, it could have. I mean, I think losing New Hampshire was probably the toughest thing we dealt with, because, you know, I assure you that was not in our campaign plan about how to become president, was losing,
right,
you know, New Hampshire. So, and we were at that point not the front runner. You know, we weren't sure we could recover. But Wright was serious, of course. I mean, it wasn't serious. It was much more serious. It was potentially devastating. But we had taken the upper hand in the primary fight. So, you know, I don't think we thought that this was going to derail the candidacy, but if we hadn't handled it properly, it could have threatened to do so. And the way we got through that, obviously, was that he decided to give a highly unconventional speech. You know, that's not in the political playbook about it, how to do damage control, is to, okay, well, we're going to lift up our problem, you know, shine a brighter spotlight on it, you know, have the campaign focused on it for a longer period of time because we've set the date for some speech. And we're not going to give kind of the standard political speech. It's going to be a very, very thoughtful historical speech on race that he obviously had to write in the wee hours of three successive nights. I mean, so once again, by defying convention, which is an important part of my book and our campaign, that was in both cases, both the speech he gave and even the idea to give that speech, I think defied political convention.
Mm-hmm.
And we benefited a great deal from it, because people said, you know what, even if Wright still bothers me, and it bothers a lot, they appreciated how he dealt with it. And it gave him the ability to put it in context.
It was, I read somewhere, and I'm wondering if you had the same response, that when David Axelrod heard that speech, he was in tears and said at the end of it, "That's why I'm working for this guy."
Yeah, well, you know, we got the speech emailed from him at, I don't know, probably 2, 3 in the morning, and in reading it, and we were up obviously waiting for it, and in reading it, you know, it was emotional. Because, you know, and I think what my thought was, you know what, even if we don't win the darn election, you know, I'm just really proud to work for this person.
Hmm.
And I think that's how we all felt. And, you know, it was, this was not a speech we had sitting on the shelf. I mean, he obviously wrote this. I mean, so and he was campaigning full time in Pennsylvania. So here it is, the most important speech he'll give in his life. You could argue that it was a make or break speech. And he's basically got to write it between like midnight and 3 a.m. You know, it's just remarkable performance. Now, as he would say, you know, when we were kind of anxious about this, the timing issues, you know, in kind of an Obama way, he would say, "Now, Davids," he would call us the Davids, "don't worry, I've been thinking about this stuff for a long time. I think I know what I want to say here." So, you know, he had confidence that he could, you know, put, I guess we used to say pen to paper, but you know, sit on the keyboard and write a beautiful speech, and he did.
Yeah. And he, not just that speech, but he had a hand in a lot of his speeches, a big hand, right?
Yeah, very unusually so. I mean, he, the announcement speech at the beginning of the campaign, he essentially wrote. The convention speech in Denver, he wrote. He spent a lot of time, obviously, on the election night speech. So, yeah, I mean, he was the best writer in our campaign, and we had some great writers in the campaign. He's probably one of the best writers in the country right now. So it was a remarkable asset to have. And it's interesting, you know, some people say, well, he's a great communicator because he can read a teleprompter. I mean, that's just ridiculous. The reason he's a great communicator is these words are all his. He's thought a lot about them. He puts a lot of time into how he wants to construct his arguments. And so that's why he's such a great communicator.
Phone calls for David in a moment. David Plouffe is our guest. His book is The Audacity to Win, the Inside Story and Lessons of Barack Obama's Historic Victory. David, of course, the campaign manager for that historic victory. To your calls in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls for David, and we'll start with Clyde from Cedarburg. Hi, Clyde.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you very much again, Kathleen, for excellent guest and for a great program. Thank you, David, for being there to answer the questions. I'm concerned about. I have a question about the Obama campaign and about the politics since the election, and I think it's important for all of us to think of, not just it's not just addressed to you, therefore, but to all of us. Through the prism of the healthcare crisis, after the election occurred, and Barack Obama won with virtually a landslide, the number one priority and strategy of the for-profit healthcare corporations became to put the solution of Medicare for All, which was a bill and had been a bill in front of Congress for a number of years, to put that off the table. The question that I have, it's understandable why they needed that. It's their top priority to get that out of the public eye and to get it out of public discussion. The question that I have is why, what did it benefit the Obama administration? What did it benefit the Democratic Party? What did it benefit the Republican Party? And what did it benefit the American people to have put, to have removed public discussion and public hearings about the single-payer solution?
Okay, David.
Well, you know, if you look at the campaign, primary and general, Barack Obama did not support a single-payer solution. He was very clear about that. What he said, largely what's reflected in these bills that are coming out of Congress are his principles, which is we're going to build on the current system, try and keep what works, improve what doesn't, and cut costs. So his goal was to obviously allow people the ability to access coverage, you know, particularly individuals when they've lost their health care. It's way too expensive. We're going to stop insurance company abuses like denial coverage or procedures are based on pre-existing conditions. So we're going to expand coverage, stop insurance company abuses, and then cut costs over time for the government. Obviously, health care costs are a huge part of our deficit problem. For businesses, you know, I meet business people all the time who'd like to hire more people but can't because of health care costs or have had to drop their employer's health care coverage. And, you know, most employers, you know, that's not what they're looking to do because it hurts productivity, obviously, as well as just being the right thing to do. So what's going to be passed, and I'm confident that something's going to pass, is, you know, a direct descendant of the principles he laid out in the campaign. So, you know, the notion that somehow he said in the campaign quite clearly he did not support a single-payer option. He wanted to, again, build on the current system and really go in and fix that what was not working, and there's quite a bit that wasn't working. That's exactly what he said in the campaign. So, you know, he's been consistent in that regard.
He has been criticized, as you well know, David, for really not taking by the bull by the horns and giving a whole lot. He has given speeches, certainly, on health care. But we don't see him on a daily level talking with people in Congress, making this bill his bill. It's their bill.
Well, but again, I think the principles he laid out, all of these bills are flowing from his principles and his approach. So, one, the content is very much, you know, a descendant, again, of both what he said in the campaign and what he's outlined. And secondly, you know, the work that he's doing, you know, when he's meeting with members of Congress and calling them on the phone, you know, it's his leadership, in my view, and still, you know, the really steady support of a lot of Americans for this that has kept this moving down the track. I mean, without his leadership, I think this would be already, sadly, off the rails. And he's keeping them moving forward. And, you know, if you know, he got the speech he gave to the House Democrats where he said, you know, this is not just a small issue. You know, this is going to define in many respects if we're going to be a strong country, not in decades to come. And we need to be on the right side of history. It is his leadership and really getting Congress. And again, it's almost all Democrats, sadly, but that's what we're dealing with, to do something that's really hard. And Washington has tended to do the easy things, as you know, in the last few decades, to do something that has real long term application, but not necessarily a huge amount of short-term benefit. You know, these are things that are anathema to Washington. And I think it's only because of his leadership that we are on, you know, to use a football analogy, kind of on the five-yard line here.
Thanks, Clyde, for the call. Jessica from Belleville, Iowa. Hi, Jessica.
Hi. I wanted to thank your guest for all of his hard work in the campaign. And the reason why I'm calling is I just came out of a meeting with Erica Meaner with Organizing for America, and she is in Davenport. She met me in Belleville, and also the Saturday I got to meet Joe Biden and give him an envelope with an idea that I share with a lot of preventative healthcare people. I am personally a massage therapist. I work out of a clinic in Dubuque, and I also work part-time with Hospice of Dubuque, and that's a brand-new position for a massage therapist to be able to care for people in that area. And my idea is it's not mine because it's everybody's idea that are involved with prevention, but is to bring all types of preventative health care together under one roof to form a preventative health care center to add to the existing traditional medicine. And I'm going to write Tom Harkin and see what his thoughts are on this, but I'm really active in the campaign. I've been making phone calls for Organizing for America and support you guys. You're like stars. I'm kind of starstruck after meeting Joe Biden, so I just have to tell you.
David.
Well, Jessica, thanks for all you did in the campaign, and particularly for what you're doing now, because I think that you know, healthcare has been attacked relentlessly all year long, really. And yet the support for it has remained relatively stable over the last few months. And I think a big reason is that people like you, and millions like you are out there having conversations with their neighbors, you know, correcting untruths, educating people about what's really in the healthcare legislation, talking about how it's going to help them. So what you're doing is going to be a big part of passing healthcare reform, and when it does pass, you should take special pride in that. I think I'm obviously not a healthcare expert, but I do know that generally, healthcare prevention, aside from allowing people to lead healthy lives, is going to be a huge, huge driver of the reduction in healthcare costs. And so some of that can be legislative, some of it can be innovative ideas like yours, some of it can be using leadership to make sure parents and children are living healthier lives. Everybody having access to healthcare, I think, will obviously help with prevention, so we catch problems before they fester and really obviously cause health issues for people, but also end up costing a lot of money. So prevention is a big, big piece of business here, and Anyway, I'm sure that folks will look up your idea, so thanks for sharing that.
Who had the idea? I just thought it was a brilliant stroke, but then again, I absolutely love Abraham Lincoln, and I'm from Illinois. So the idea, though, to make this announcement in Springfield, Illinois, I just thought was genius.
Well, you might expect me to say this, but I'm not just cheerleading for my boss. Barack Obama did.
Hmm.
And I think that, and I can't remember, the old state capitol is the venue, that was either his direct idea or one of ours, but the idea was to do it there. Obviously, you do have the Lincoln connection, but also, it's a place where, in a state legislature, he had done a lot of tough things, kind of brought people together. It was a great example of the kind of leadership he hoped to bring. So, yeah, it was great. And, we went back there for Joe Biden's.
Right.
The announcement of Joe Biden. So it was a special place in the campaign for us.
I love the description, though, of, whether we're going to have this inside or outside, 10 degrees, too cold, I got to wear a coat, they will have to wear gloves. Are you guys going to have warmers in your gloves? I mean, all the little, they're not little things, they're big things when it's cold. What about the people in the audience? Are they going to be too cold, Michelle asks, if they bring their children, et cetera? There are a lot of details to what went pretty flawlessly.
Yeah, no, there was. And, it's. I remember, about a week out from the announcement, it was below zero in Chicago.
Oh, yeah.
And we were cheered by the fact that the long-term forecast for announcement day was like 12, because that was balmy compared to what it had been. But it was a tough call to do it outside. And we thought, obviously, it's a beautiful building. We wanted to be able to attract a lot of people. The rain site there was limited in space. So, and we wanted to be a grassroots campaign. We didn't want to be exclusionary. We just thought also, having a big crowd outside on a bitter day would signal the kind of an initial level of support. But no, yeah, I mean, but also you didn't want him chattering his way through the speech, and you didn't want people getting frostbite and having a miserable experience. So it was a tough call, and really was something that, it was a coin flip. But I think what's interesting is you read this book, time and time again, we kind of rolled the dice on things and defied convention, and almost every time we benefited from that. And I think that probably tells you something about sort of the stale political playbook, that it's probably in need of a serious rewrite.
Mm-hmm. And then you were watching him during the Lincoln Memorial Concert. His eyes, as you say, were on Abraham Lincoln for a good chunk of that. Because why?
Well, I think I was sitting. My family was sitting with his family and the Biden family during that amazing concert that Saturday, I believe, afternoon. U2 was performing, and Barack Obama would be taking the stage next to deliver brief remarks. So, you know, as Bono's singing, you know, I notice him kind of gaze off to his left, and you know, he was clearly looking at Lincoln, and he didn't just glance. He kind of, you know, was taking that all in. I assumed he was reading the inscription. And, you know, that was a powerful moment to me. Again, as I said at our first discussion of the show, you know, we didn't focus much on the history. But to see,
right,
you know, our first African-American president, who's, you know, people like him not too long ago in this country could not eat or use the restroom or vote everywhere they wanted to, you know, to be taking the stage as our next president, you know, at the memorial built in honor of the great emancipator, it really took my breath away. And so, you know, when I talked to him about it afterwards, he just said, yeah, he was, you know, this is a big moment. He was speaking to the country, and he got the history of it, and he always looked to Lincoln for inspiration. So that was a private moment that I actually hesitated to put in the book, but I thought it was a pretty important scene.
Yeah, I'm glad you did. I those are important moments because it is a momentous thing that happened.
Yeah, really was. That was, you know, and actually going to the concert, honestly, I hadn't really focused on the fact that we were going to the Lincoln Memorial, right? And it wasn't until I got there, you know, it kind of struck me that, wow, you know, he is sitting on the Lincoln Memorial, you know, that was really, really something. You look down the mall at the Capitol where the great civil rights debates not too long ago raged. It was remarkable.
Yeah. Here's a guy who crafts these extraordinary speeches. He just never misses. He's always inspirational, beautiful user of words. Loves to be, though, a policy wonk, would rather do nothing more than just sit around and talk about policy matters all night long, and you can see that part of him as well. Did that not serve him well in terms of getting him up and ready to go, fired up, ready to go for all of this heavy-duty campaigning? I know you talk a couple times about when his energy was down, which is understandable, but is it because his nature is to be another kind of guy?
Well, no, I think that, you know, he is someone who, well, first of all, you know, he was very steady over most of the campaign, so he performed well, but there's no doubt he's kind of a red light player. You know, he really, you know, his speech practices would never lend you to believe that, you know, he was going to deliver the speech the way he ultimately did. Certainly, I think he performed better in debates than our debate prep. You know, we took that seriously. So, but I think that one of the powerful ways he communicated was he did not speak like in the language of politics people have been accustomed to. You know, the really sort of, you know, cute political sound bites, you know, that are kind of like fast food in a way. They sound great, but they kind of leave you hungry moments later. He would explain things to people in both his speeches and his debate answers and his town halls. He would even engage in complexity and, dare I say,
yes,
nuance. Things that, you know, you're told in politics today you cannot do. But what we saw, you know, in Wisconsin and all across the country is that people were hungry for that. They wanted someone, you know, to discuss these issues, to listen, to say, well, on the one hand, you could do this, on the other hand, that. And that's what people were hungry for. Now, some of that was, I think, a reaction to the previous 8 years. But I will tell you what's interesting. Younger voters who obviously have not absorbed politics for a long time, I can't tell you how many times we'd hear in the campaign younger voters say, the reason I'm helping him, voting for him, is I heard him on the radio or over the internet, and, you know, he just didn't sound like all the rest of the politicians I've listened to growing up. You know, there was something about him, and I think it was the trust that he had in the American people that they could have an adult conversation.
Wayne from Holman, hi.
Good morning.
Hi, Wayne.
Good morning. Good morning, Kathleen. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
Let me just say, I didn't vote for Barack Obama, but I greatly admire him. I think he's the kind of fella that you could disagree with agreeably in a conversation, and that's what I look for. I think that's sorely lacking today in the American politics. But my question, David, would be, during the campaign with John McCain, or prior or leading up to it, both men had agreed to take public funding. And John McCain took public funding, and after he did, Barack Obama bowed out and said, no, I'm going to go for the other form of funding. Why did he agree to take public funding, and then after John McCain took it, he did not?
Well, I talk about this. Well, first of all, thank you for the comments on the president. I think, you know, and that's just going to be the way he leads. And, you know, he gets criticized a lot even from his own party for not attacking more and, you know, kind of being overly political and partisan. But that's just not how he thinks we need to lead in this moment. And over time, I think that change of approach and tone maybe will have an impact long term, and I think it'd be valuable. On public financing, first of all, John McCain, you know, took public financing in the primary. He signed loan documents. He was given a loan that kept his campaign afloat and allowed him to win New Hampshire, to get access to the ballot in a number of states where he didn't have to pay or get signatures. He was just granted access. And then he reversed himself because he wanted extra money because our primary was going to last longer. So he wanted to be able to raise money to attack us. So, you know, this is somebody who had already broken his word in a fundamental way. What we committed to was trying to aggressively pursue an agreement with the Republican nominee to allow us both to be in the public financing system. Part of that is outside spending. How are we going to deal with our national parties? How are we going to deal with the 527 and outside groups? It was clear the McCain folks had no interest in dealing with that. And without that, we thought that, you know, the kind of campaign we were running, raising money from grassroots Americans, we got 4 million contributors, average contribution $85, teachers and retirees making up our two top categories of donors, no money from lobbyists or PACs, the only candidate in presidential history not to do that. And, you know, if we went into the public financing system, as it turned out, we'd spend all our money raising money for our national party, as John McCain did. And that's not $2,300 limits. That's $30,000 limits. So we'd be running around funding our campaign completely on the backs of wealthy interests and individuals. So, you know, we were proud of the kind of campaign we ran. McCain did actually break his word in a fundamental way. And we couldn't trust that we were going to have an agreement that dealt with this outside spending. Now, in the book, I say this was a hard decision because Barack Obama, in both Illinois and Washington, was a reformer, not just in spirit, but in deed. And so this is a hard decision, but I think at the end of the day, it was the right one on the merits.
Thanks, Wayne, for your call. We have time for a couple more phone calls for David. David Plouffe is our guest. His book, The Audacity to Win, The Inside Story and Lessons of Barack Obama's Historic Victory, has just been published. David, of course, the campaign manager for that historic victory. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I want to spend just a few moments with David talking about some of the down things that happened with him and also with Obama. And I think that all of us watching the campaign as closely as we did, oh my gosh, I was involved hours every day watching that campaign, that there were times when we could see that Obama seemed kind of down. And David, you write about his missing his family, spending much of his time fundraising, finding most of the coverage of the race banal, and there wasn't nearly enough time for his favorite part of the campaign, noodling over policy, or as he called it, think time. Gibbs asked him, he wanted to have a heart-to-heart, "Are you having any fun at all?" he asked him. "None," Obama flatly replied. "Do you see any way we can make it more fun?" Gibbs replied, "No."
Yeah.
But obviously you did, because there was a long road ahead.
Yeah, and I think what happened, you know, we were kind of shot out of a cannon. You know, we weren't planning to run. We were scrambling around to get a campaign built. There was a lot of energy in the beginning. And so I think we were all, you know, working on adrenaline. But as you got a couple months into it, 3 months into it, you know, it really kicked in. He wasn't seeing his family at all. Obviously, the political coverage was getting more and more negative about our prospects because Hillary had such a big lead. You know, you're out in these early states like Iowa, and, you know, you think of Barack Obama in the campaign holding these big rallies and a lot of energy, and obviously you're bouncing around Iowa meeting with 20, 30 people at a time, none of them agreeing to support you. So it was hard, and I think that, you know, it was something, and for the first time in his life, he was having the entire, national press corps and political community pour through his entire life, right? You know, looking at inconsistencies or trying to find them. And so that's no fun. You're kind of going through a proctological exam. So, you know, it was something, but he clicked in. And I think as he really nailed exactly how he wanted to explain what he wanted to do as president to people, and he's a community organizer. So the Iowa campaign grew, and he really got into the organizational element of it, the relationship with our volunteers and precinct captains. He clicked in. And really, I'd say from late summer till election day of 08, you know, he was having a really good time out there, and I think it showed. But in the beginning, there's no doubt we struggled, and he struggled.
Yeah. So are you going to go work in the White House at some point? I know you're thinking about joining the administration again.
Well, listen, I made clear, you know, we had a new daughter who was born 2 days after the election.
Yeah,
and, you know,
that's
with
great.
A young family, we just I didn't want to do another 2 years where I was sort of an absentee spouse and parent.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm taking a couple years to spend more time with my family. I wrote the book, obviously, which gave me time to do that. And so we'll see where things stand. If I'm needed down the road, you know, I think my family will be ready to sign back up because we believe so much in his leadership. So what form that takes and when it is, we'll see. But I imagine at some point my days of, you know, going to the playground with my son after school are over, and I will be back, you know, working around the clock for Barack Obama.
And are you happy with him? Does he disappoint you at all in how he's governed?
He doesn't, and part of it is because, you know, I was there every day. I knew exactly what he wanted to try and do as president. He's trying to do it. I don't get impatient like others because I know how hard it is. By the way, that's why we ran for president, because we thought it was hard, that on health care, on energy, on education, the tough things weren't getting done, and we needed someone like him from the outside, someone who had kind of a longer-term strategic view, the ability not to govern as we didn't campaign based on kind of the press narrative of the moment. And that's really unique, by the way, to really say, you know, I know we're getting battered about right now, but we just got to get 60 votes on health care, and that's what I'm focused on. So I'm not. I think that, and on the economy, by the way.
We can't do the economy because we don't have any time, but we'll get to it. Thanks, David, so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me very much. Thank you.
Yeah, the book is The Audacity to Win, the Inside Story and Lessons of Barack Obama's Historic Victory. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour and John Treader for on-air production. Thanks for your calls. This is the Ideas Network.